Hello, this is Francis Hammett. I'm the author of The Shenandoah Spy, an exciting Civil War novel about Belle Boyd, the Confederate Army spy and scout, who was 17 when she started in 1861. The novel follows her to her first arrest in 1862. She was one of the most effective spies that the South had, and she was the first woman in American history to be formally commissioned an Army officer at the age of 18. This novel tells you pretty much how she did it. Now, on November 8, 2008, I gave a speech at the West Coast Civil War Roundtable Conference in Clovis, California, which was about Belle and the Confederate Secret Service. This is given to you for personal use only. It is copyrighted 2009 by Brass Cannon Books, which is also the publisher of The Shenandoah Spy. The Shenandoah Spy is available at fine bookstores every place and on Amazon.com. Its list price is $18.95. Sometimes you can find it a little cheaper than that. At BrassCannonBooks.net, we have a signed copy sale also available. Anyway, enjoy the podcast, and hopefully you will also buy the book. Thank you.
Francis Hammett, our next speaker, he wrote a book on Belle Boyd. He's going to talk to us about that novel and also about the intelligence in the Confederacy. He's a longtime researcher and writer. He has published over 1,000 articles, and we have a book over there. It's actually enough for everybody here to take a copy home of it. On Belle Boyd. Now, if you mentioned Belle Boyd to the general population, they wondered what the hell are you talking about. But this group knows who we're talking about. Belle was quite a spy. So, my pleasure to introduce Francis Hammett.
Thank you, sir. Well, I have to give a range on this thing. Okay. My name is Francis Hammett. I've been a writer for about 43 years now. I was one before I went in the Army, and I've been one ever since. I come from an Army family, and I came across the Belle Boyd story in the early 1980s when I was working for the Encyclopedia Britannica as one of 4,000 people hired to help with the revisions on the Micropedia. I did her biography that you find there. Now, Belle fascinated me because she was a 17-year-old girl who became a spy against the social conventions of her time. A very brave young lady. She started out by killing a Union soldier who was part of a drunken crew of soldiers on July 4, 1861. And it was basically a home invasion. They were trying to bully her family into raising a Union flag over the house, and they were searching for artifacts that she had in her room, which her personal servant, Eliza Corsi, tore down and took down and threw in the kitchen stove. All of this is recounted in the book. Belle decided she'd be a spy, but that wasn't the kind of thing that young ladies did back then. It wasn't respectable. She was of a certain class of woman. She'd been presented in Washington. She was getting a little bit long in the tooth at 17 to make a good marriage. But she was also a very good horsewoman. It's reputed that she could ride standing on the saddle at a full gallop. She'd actually done that, apparently, and been seen doing it. They used to have this thing that was sort of a then version of what we now call Rit Fair, called Tournament. And this was a cultural phenomenon that rose from the novels of Sir Walter Scott, which really appealed to the Scots-Irish population of Southern Virginia, started calling themselves the chivalry at having these events, where they would joust, they would go for the lady's favor, they had all of these things. And one of the most prominent people of this was a fellow named Turner Ashby, who, when the war started coming on, formed a militia unit called the Mountain Rangers, which was incorporated into the then Virginia Army and then the Confederate Army as the 7th Virginia Cavalry. Turner Ashby was, as Stonewall Jackson so kindly put it, a great partisan leader. As a regular Army officer, he and his troops didn't really measure up. And this was the bone of contention between him and Jackson, which is recounted in the book. They were basically not so much a cavalry unit as a untrained, undisciplined mob. They refused to drill. Ashley never filed any written reports. That wasn't part of his thing. And he had used political influence to get his promotion to general, to brigadier. So he wasn't really a favorite of Stonewall Jackson's. And I always thought of that statement that Jackson made upon his death as something that was written by a staff officer that was carefully nuanced so that Jackson would not, you know, sort of set the apple cart by saying what he really thought of the man. The Confederate Secret Service did exist. We know this because there's just enough record left to give us a pretty good idea of what it was, when it was, and the size of it. But all of the detailed records that would tell us who did what, with whom, and when, and who the agents were, especially in the North, were all burned on April 2nd, 1865. You remember that fire that destroyed about a third of Richmond? It started in a tobacco warehouse. My theory is that that's where the Secret Service records were kept, and that Judah P. Benjamin, who was the chief of the service, torched them himself to protect his people. Judah P. Benjamin, by the way, was the only member of the Confederate cabinet to escape. Everybody else was arrested by the Union. That's sort of interesting. And the tale of him getting out of the country is in itself a pretty good adventure. But there was an extensive Confederate Secret Service operation in Europe. They were trying to raise funds for and create a Blue Water Navy. The entire Confederate Blue Water Navy, the Confederate cruisers, were all the Secret Service. The Hunter was a Secret Service operation. The entire thing was financed pretty much on the fly. Now, you wonder, how did they do this overnight? Well, the answer is that they didn't. There were motions to break up the country going back to the days of John Calhoun, and he died in 1849. There was a big secessionist movement. There were the men who wore the blue cockade in their hat who were civil servants from Washington. They had indicated their Southern sympathies. And mysterious things happened during the 1850s, during the Buchanan administration. All of the maps of the South disappeared from the Department of the Interior and had to be redone. They didn't have any maps of their own country. This is kind of inconvenient if you have military action, not having any maps. But the other thing was that there seemed to be all of these secret societies. There were a lot of things that had to do with the Freemasons that are very mysterious. And of course, the Masons never tell anything about anybody, but there are enough ex-Masons who go and talk about it that you can sort of get an idea. There were secret codes going back and forth. It was an international organization. It didn't have a whole lot to do with espionage, but they were very secretive. They had ceremonies, and they had certain social obligations and loyalties that were higher than the local government. Masons were obligated to each other even during the Civil War, and this is one of their points of pride, that a northern Mason could cry out for assistance on the battlefield and that the southern Mason would rescue him, or would take him in, or would providing food and shelter. And they cite instances of that. I did learn a great deal about it from reading various stuff by the Catholic Church, who considered the Masons a competing religion and would like to communicate, supposedly, any Catholic who joins the Masons. Was there a Confederate Secret Service? Definitely. And you can sort of dope out, if you really dig and dig and dig, who the people had to be who were running it. I picked Alexander Butler, who was a congressman originally in the 1850s from Northern Virginia, and then a Confederate congressman from the same district as being the probable chief of the Secret Service in my novel, the field chief. Because he fits the description of the people that Bell described and were described by other people as being, he's really the only possible operative. Now, he's an interesting guy. He was a second cousin of a fellow named David Hunter Strother, who was a Virginia Yankee, who was known, wrote and proved for Harper's Magazine under the pseudonym Jorge Crayon, did a lot of travel books in the 1850s. And when he went to the Union, they first employed him as a volunteer mapmaker to try and redraw the maps of Virginia for the military. And then they commissioned him a captain and finally got him on board. Even though he knew he was going to have all sorts of grief from his own family over it, he was for the Union. The war was not, at the beginning, about slavery. It was about whether or not we preserved this country as one country. And he had his own viewpoint, which he recounted in articles. He was, by coincidence, the only reporter on the scene when John Brown raided Harper's Ferry. And he did a series of articles under his own name for Harper's about that, which you can find online and read. He was a very good writer, by the way. So a lot of his material I used as research, and some of his better lines I incorporated as dialogue into my novel. He became a principal counterpoint character because he was obviously the guy who chose country above tribe and family, whereas Belle and her family went the other way entirely. It was Virginia, it was, this is our family, this is what we believe in, and your loyalty led to us. The divided loyalty thing is very much a sub-theme of the Civil War. There were all sorts of women who were involved. And this originally started out to be like one book. It's now going to be five. This first novel, The Shenandoah Spy, covers the first year of Belle's career. July 1861, when she shot the Union soldier, to July 1862, when the Union finally wised up and arrested her. Put her in old Capitol prison. In between, there was a little thing called the Battle of Front Royal, which is, since the theme of this conference is about the Shenandoah Valley campaign in 1862, you should all be familiar with. Belle was instrumental in creating that situation. She was involved with a Union staff officer named Daniel Kiley. Daniel Kiley was one of the planners of the attempt by Shields' army and Banks' army to capture Stonewall Jackson's army and destroy it. She listened in on his presentation, knowing about it from having talked to him. They were lovers, quite obviously. She rode 15 miles in the dead of night, very dramatically, to find Turner Ashby, pounding, gives him the basic rundown and intelligence report of what the Union is planning. He takes it to Jackson. She rides 15 miles back, is not discovered. And she's working from the middle of the Union Army headquarters because the Union officers like their comforts and they like taking over hotels. And she's at her uncle's hotel in Front Royal. So by coincidence, she's in a perfect position to spy upon the Union. They already know that she's a spy, and they don't believe it. She's been publicly accused in the newspapers of being a spy, and they don't believe it. And they're very incautious around her, and they drink a lot. This was one of the characteristics of the 19th century. If you weren't temperate, you were a drunk. It didn't seem to be any middle ground. And there weren't a whole lot of temperance people in the Union Army or the Confederate one either. A lot of what happened could be explained by the fact that they were probably drunk at the time. But the women did not drink, and they made very effective spies. In Washington, D.C., you had Rose Greenhouse, who was the pearl best of her day, who created aspiring out-of-society women, about 50 of them. She had all of this information that she was sending south. She gave the South a heads-up on what the plan of attack would be for the Union Army at Manassas, allowed the Confederate Army to surprise the Union Army at Manassas and beat them cold. And had that not happened, the Civil War might have been a very short one, because they really didn't have a professional army at that point. They didn't have all of these 90-day militia units. And a few months later, when my book starts, here's Belle. The entire town has been invaded by a bunch of people from Pennsylvania who are in uniform but are not really an army either. They've been raised on them. They're going to be there for 3 months, right? They barely know how to do a proper drill. And something very unfortunate happened on July 3rd when they took over the town. They found the local distillery. And command, being smart about these things, says, well, destroy that whiskey. So they did. But the Irishman from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, they decided the best way to do that was to pass it through their bodies. With the predictable results. So here we have Bell's house being invaded by people that are not very kind, people who are basically already abusing the local populace and stealing. And this was a theme of the Union volunteer regiments in the early part of the war and throughout the war, that they would do this. There was a lot of animosity created there. Now, yesterday, the speaker mentioned the difference between the 1862 campaign and the 1864 campaign, and how it might have been different in 1862 if they had just put the hammer down the way Sheridan did. Well, that wasn't going to happen, because the generals in charge of those regiments and those divisions were all politicians. They weren't professional army officers. They were interested in making peace. They were treating it like they were running for office. They wanted to make nice with the locals. And the locals were basically, some of them were unionists and some of them were not. But the more that they got this treatment from the lower level troops and this bullying and theft and all of these other things, the lack of civil control and civil disorder, the more and more that they tended to be inclined towards the South. The entire state of West Virginia was basically created by Lincoln's law partner and bodyguard, Ward Hill Lamon, who was from Martinsburg, going down there and talking to a bunch of people he knew in those five counties and assuring them that civil order would be restored, that there would be a civil guard, that, you know, things would be brought under control and that they wouldn't have this really anomalous situation. And on that basis, the state of West Virginia was created. Ward Hill Lamon pretty much gets the credit for that. And he was basically acting as a political operative for Lincoln. He did a lot of little missions for Lincoln throughout the war. He was a very sort of large, fierce man, apparently, known to be very good in a fight, and Lincoln specifically requested that he come to Washington to take up the job of protecting him. There was no real Secret Service at the time. That was created by Lafayette Baker about midway through the war, after Baker had worked for the Army for a while, and then got transferred over to the Treasury Department. Baker was an interesting case. He was basically a teetotaling Bible-thumping thug from San Francisco who had been a vigilante. And he admired the methods applied by Vidal, who was the chief of police in Paris. It was an interesting case in himself because he'd been a master criminal, and then they hired him to basically crack down on all the criminals, and he did that by, among other things, taking evidence against them. He knew who the guilty people were, so the facts didn't really matter. And that was Napoleonic code, that wasn't our code, so Mr. Baker was not well loved, and by the end of the war, he was generally despised by everybody who knew him. He wrote a book, which he self-published, called The History of the U.S. Secret Service, which has an interesting chapter about Bell Boyd. And you sort of get the idea of how accurate he was, because he describes Bell Boyd as being 5'6", black-haired and very pretty. She wasn't. She was 5'10". She had red-brown hair. If you look at the cover of the Shenandoah Spy, that woman on the cover there is based on archival photographs of the period. That's a sort of upscale and glamorized version of Bell. That Colt Dragoon revolver she's holding is the one that was taken from her in 1862 by the Secret Service, Union Secret Service. And that map background, folks, is from Harry Kit Douglas's I Rode the Stonewall. It's the map that Stonewall Jackson allegedly used during the Valley Campaign. I thought that would make a nice sort of thematic cover, you know, when we put it together. So, who were the other spies? Well, Bell had a friend named Antonio Ford that she dedicated her book to. Antonio Ford worked with Mosby. She helped Mosby capture a brigadier general, Union brigadier general named Stout, young man, in Fairfax Courthouse. You begin to see the pattern emerging here of a completely organized service. And you wonder, how was this possible? Well, they had sort of a head start on it because of all the conspiracies in Washington. Once Buchanan was out, Greenhow was fully on board. Thomas Jordan, who had been General Scott's aide-de-camp, and went south, recruited her to spy for the South. She started sending this tremendous volume of information, most of it political, because that's what she knew, But the military information she had was very sound because she had among her various suitors a fellow named Henry Wilson, who was chairman of the Senate Military Committee. Men back then like to drink, they like to talk to women. The idea of security discipline was problematical at best. It wasn't until there was no real professional intelligence organization on either side. They sort of made it up as they went along. Alan Pinkerton came in. He was a great detective. He was the social intelligence chief because he was easily led. And he followed the lead of his boss, who was McClellan. And McClellan always wanted to see more troops than were there, and he was easy to fool. You know, McClellan had this perfect army that he didn't want to use because he might get a gimmick or something. A little slow on the concept of what an army was really for. You know, that was commented on by people above him extensively, including Lincoln's famous line that if McClellan wasn't used in the army, Lincoln would like to borrow it for a bit. The entire thing, the entire Confederate Secret Service, was aimed at creating a new nation. And yet, you sort of had to wonder what exactly was going on with the, well, among other things, the British. Because the British supported, quite obviously, the Confederate Secret Service in the early part of the war, up until Gettysburg. The British were providing a great deal of covert support to the South in one way or another. They were training Confederate Secret Service agents in England, for one thing. There were three clergymen who went over there. For some reason, the clergy seemed to like this kind of work. I don't know what it was. Of course, the Jesuits were the original international secret service. There were influences on all sides. They were desperate for professional military officers in the North. They started importing them. There's a fellow in the book named Sir Percy Wyndham. You know, that sounds like a ridiculous made-up name, but the guy actually existed. He had been a brigadier in the Italian army. He got knighted in Italy for his service during the Italian War to King Victor Emmanuel. He comes over here, he's immediately made a colonel. Couldn't quite get a general slot because he wasn't a citizen. He's made a colonel of the 1st New Jersey. And he determines that Turner Ashby is basically this farmer with ideas about his station, and he's going to capture it. And what happened was that Ashby captured him instead. Trapped him. That's recounted in the book. I'm not going to spoil the explanatory if you want to read the book. But basically, that happened the same day that Ashby got killed, which was the same day that Rose Greenhow was released from Old Capitol Prison, finally, after months and months of being held there with her 8-year-old daughter. The Union came down very hard on this stuff because they didn't know what they were dealing with. There was a lot of just, we don't know what we've got here. We've got a rebellion. We don't know where it came from. We don't know what it's doing. The thing had been building for years, but people hadn't really been paying attention. And the secret part of it was kept secret for various devices. Belle Boyd became the first woman in American history to be formally commissioned an Army officer. And that happens after the run of this particular part of the narrative in September of 1862. But they had a big ceremony. Stonewall Jackson makes her a captain, makes her a Navy cap. She's in uniform. One of the reasons for that is that if she's in uniform, working in the field, she can't be hung, she can't be shot as a spy. And at that point, they were beginning to get worried about her because she'd already been in prison once. Belle went to prison, and unlike Rose Greenhow, Belle was such a problem to them as a prisoner that they exchanged her after a month. During that time, she got engaged to another Confederate soldier. And the warden of the prison, one William Wood, decides because she's the daughter of a Mason, he's obligated to protect her. And he not only gets her out of jail, he buys her trousseau from Elizabeth Kentley in Washington, D.C., and sends it south under a flag of truce. Marriage never happened. And you might have an interesting speculation about that. Might have something to do with Belle having been slammed in the newspapers as, quote, an accomplished prostitute, unquote, by a reporter that she obviously hated and wouldn't sleep with. I don't think Belle was a bad girl. I think Belle basically did what a lot of Southern women do. She flirted. She used her sexuality as a weapon. She was able to listen very carefully. She was very, very, very smart. And there had to be some training there. And it wouldn't have been hard to come by. It's a matter of anybody can learn this stuff. It's not rocket science. If you have an interest, well, Belle had the interest. Belle started out being a nurse. She did that for 2 months until she got overworked and got sick of it. And then she was a courier. And then after that, they finally started sending on little missions because they realized that her heart was totally dedicated to the cause. She wasn't some silly girl just trying to have an adventure. And they needed people like her. Now, there's a very interesting document that you can find in one of the anthologies, a newspaper report from about a year after that, about a whole bunch of women, including Belle. When the Union forces come into town, they all approach them, and they're all very friendly to them, and they all take them aside, and they all say, where are you from, and what are you doing? And they're basically interrogating them, and then they all get together, and they compare their notes, and they have a complete order of battle on the unit that's just come in, and who the commanding officers are, and the other officers, and they can relay this to the Confederate Secret Service. Now, that's a level of sophistication far above 1862. And we're talking about 1863 here is the date of that report. There was a Confederate Secret Service, and there were apparently a lot of women in it. Now, I'm not quite sure how we got there. You know, I will make something because I'm basically a novelist to sort of explain all of that. But that's what's called in the intelligence trade an indicator. There are all sorts of indicators even though the records are gone. There are parts of the official records under the Department of Navy that come out of a trove of documents that Jacob Thompson, several years after the war, sold to the Indian government. Jacob Thompson was former Secretary of the Interior, sometimes known as Major Thompson, sometimes known as Colonel Thompson, basically was running in the latter part of the war the Confederate Secret Service in Canada, and there was an extensive operation in Canada as well. And when Belle made her final trip, she had to go through there, through Thompson, to get to England. In England, they had not only Commander Bullock, who was going around getting ships built and these kind of things, he was a naval architect and naval officer and knew what to do about that. He also had a propaganda chief named Henry Hotsey. Henry Hotsey was a Swiss. He had come to Alabama. He had been a private there. He spoke about 6 languages, and he was a newspaper man. And they basically, Judah Benjamin picks him out and says, I want you to go to England and create propaganda for us. And he did this by, among other things, subverting the entire staff of the VAS, the French version of the Associated Press. And the Associated Press did exist back then. And by getting people in England to write very favorable articles about the South, paying them far more than the papers that published the articles paid them, basically bribing them. So this is classic propaganda operation. We also had the Confederate cotton bombs, so that was another Secret Service operation, which was basically orchestrated by John Slidell with his in-laws, the Erlingers. One of his daughters married Barry Erlinger, ended up being a baroness. He was involved in that whole thing with the Trent. It was taken off of the Trent, the Royal Mail, and we nearly had another war over that until Lincoln decided he could only handle one war at a time, thank you, and basically had Slidell and his secretary released. That was sort of an indication of a lack of discipline. There was a big Confederate station in Bermuda that people were going in and out of. We have documents from Rose Greenhow that show up in various archives. There were letters to Alexander Butler that she wrote complaining about various things in England, like her money not coming through, but not getting the acknowledgement of her reports, which gives us a pretty good idea that the Union had an operation on the ground which was intercepting those reports. All of this is supposition on my part. It would not stand the test that you have to have for a historian. And I'm not an historian. I'm a novelist. I tell stories. I made a lot of it up, but I made a lot of it up based upon the facts that are already out there. So basically, Belle Boyd became famous as a spy, which is sort of a contradiction in terms. So was she, as later male historians put it, simply a girl who exaggerated her role, or was she the real thing? Well, at the end of her life, she was going around doing a recitation for the Grand Grand Army of the Republic hold the perils of a spy, recounting her youthful adventures, the midnight ride to Ashby and all of this, and some of the things that she did along the Rappahannock as a captain of scouts. And she was in Kilbourne, Wisconsin, and had a heart attack and died. This was in 1900, June 10th. She had been married at that time. She was on her third marriage. Nobody from the South would marry her after that because her reputation had been ruined. So she was married to this fellow that she basically met and seduced on the blockade runner she was trying to get to England on. It was overtaken by the Union. By the time they got to New York, he proposed marriage. She'd accepted, and then she helped the captain, the Confederate captain of the ship, escape and got him court-martialed. He chases her to England. August 24th at St. Paul's Cathedral in 1864, they have this really big marriage, which makes the front page of the London Times. And by November, this fellow, Samuel Harding, is at the Union Ministry offering to sell her out because they're starving and they have no money. And being refused because the Union operation has basically dried up all of the funds for the Confederate Secret Service in England. They had found a way to shut them down. Despite that, the last Confederate cruiser gets launched, the Shenandoah. And that in itself is another amazing story. The Civil War is full of amazing stories like this that have never been covered. Most novelists go for a big battle. Sherman's march on Atlanta, Gettysburg, this kind of thing. There are all sorts of little side stories, and the Valley Campaign should not be a side story, but it apparently is because nobody's really done a novel about it before. And I took it from the standpoint of Bell Wood because Bell was military intelligence, and I feel a certain empathy there, and I sort of understand how intelligence operations operate. A lot of the tradecraft and so forth you'll find is just classic stuff that anybody, any organization would do. There are dead drops, there are agents, there are deception agents sent to the enemy to give them false information or to give them accurate information which will lead them into a trap. There are all sorts of things that happen there. Now, as a researcher, one of the things that I ended up doing was reading a lot of opposition material. I got a lot of information about Bill from the diary of Lucy Buck, who was a woman who lived in Front Royal and kept a diary starting Christmas Day of 1861 to the end of the war, which has been published. And she really hated Bill. She really did. But it gives you time and place for what Bill was doing. And it also gives you an attitude of the women of the town, of whom Lucy was one. Not women of the town, but women who lived in the town. Let's be clear about that. Because they thought, you know, they accused Belle of being a woman of the town, which was an euphemism for a prostitute. And Belle was not well-loved in Front Royal, and her cousin suffered that. Her cousin Alice suffered on account of it, and her uncle's family basically booted out for Richmond, left her and Alice in charge of a hotel there, which they had a big investment in and couldn't just walk away. Now, just tracking down the proper name of the hotel could be a major problem. Because in the later part of the 19th century, it was known as Strickland House. In the original drafts of the book, I had it as Strickland House. But it wasn't Strickland House during the war. It was something else entirely. So I had to get to the original name, and in my original draft, I had the hotel being a quarter mile from the train station. Turns out it's across the street. The building's still there. So you have to walk the ground when you do these things. What are my obligations as a novelist when I'm dealing with an audience like you? You guys know far more about the Civil War than I ever will. You know it in depth, you know it broadly, and you know all these fine, finicky little details which will create dissonance if I don't get them right. So I had to be particularly careful about the research because I knew that some of you would be reading this book, and if I got it wrong, you sure as heck would let everybody know. So I was very, very careful about the research. Now, what I hope I've done is present a seamless narrative because there's a professor of history at Harvard named Jill Lepore who writes for The New Yorker. And a few months ago, she wrote a column in The New Yorker about historical fiction. But anyway, she pointed out that some historical fiction can get close to the actual emotional truth of a time than all of these academic recitations of you go back and forth of who said what. It's a problem for conventional historians. I was reading Barbara Tuchman's A Distant Mirror about the original chivalry, the knights in the 14th century, which she revolved around one particular French knight. And she at one point says, well, we have this on this side, but these people say exactly the opposite, and I don't know which one is right. Okay, for a historian, that's good. That's accurate. That gives you an idea. For a novelist, that's just absolutely deadly. You can't do that. You have to have a clean narrative line. You have to keep it flowing. You have to keep people entertained. You know, it's tapestry, basically. You've got to keep your rhythm. So you can't do that. So in my book, it's sort of a seduction of people into reading regular history. Think of it that way. Maybe they'll get interested enough to research what the actual truth is or what the people say the actual truth is. But I'll make this observation about original sources because I'm kind of cynical, having been an intelligence professional. Autobiography is very seldom doing harm to their subjects, number one. Secondly, letters are written to third parties and they are always written with a filter. There are certain things you don't want that party to know. Getting to the actual truth of what happened is almost impossible even for a professional historian. I don't have a PhD in history. I don't have a degree in history. I have an interest in history as a good story. Like to research. I wouldn't have had the job with the Britannica if I hadn't. I did 93 articles for them. I did a book on virtual reality, which we spent 2.5 years on getting it right. It was originally going to be a 6-month project. I'm a little bit dedicated because I'm a journalist by training inclination. I'm a novelist. I'm a playwright. And I understand the difference between truth and fiction very well. But what I write in this particular instance is not one or the other, but sort of a blend which we might call faction. Okay. All right.